You've heard from the radical right. Now all the...
This is the Quality News Network. The Senate Judiciary Committee will vote Tuesday on President Bush's nominee for Attorney General Michael Mukasey, who has submitted nearly 200 pages of elaboration on his positions. However, Mukasey has reportedly not given a definitive answer on whether the controversial technique known as waterboarding is torture. Many Democrats have said it is illegal and they will not vote for him unless he categorically answers the question. The Democratic candidates running for president in 2008 took part in a televised debate last night in Philadelphia. Senator Barack Obama and former Senator John Edwards took on frontrunner Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. They challenged her candor and consistency. President Bush is trying to take the offensive against Congress in health care policy and other budget issues. He accused Democrats of supporting federalized health care instead of a free market approach that he favors. In Spain, 7 of the 28 people on trial for the 2004 Madrid train bombings were let off entirely, including one suspect who had allegedly bragged that he was the mastermind behind the blasts. However, 21 people were convicted on at least some of the charges. A 25-year-old man pleaded guilty today in connection with an alleged plot to attack soldiers at Fort Dix. He faces up to 5 years in federal prison. The five other men arrested in the case face more serious charges. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Defense Secretary Robert Gates announced that all State Department convoys in Iraq will now be under U.S. military control. This is the latest step following the recent shooting incident that killed 17 Iraqis involved the private security company Blackwater, which protects American diplomats in Iraq. A boy younger than the age of 13 playing with matches has admitted to accidentally starting one of the recent devastating Southern California wildfires. The blaze destroyed 21 homes and consumed more than 38,000 acres. The case will be presented to the district attorney's office. The San Francisco Bay Area was hit with a 5.6 magnitude earthquake last night. It was the largest quake since the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. There were no reports of serious injuries or damage. One of President Bush's longtime political advisors announced she is leaving her government post at the end of the year. Karen Hughes has been working as the Undersecretary of State to improve the U.S. image overseas. You're listening to the Quality News Network, Science and Business Next.
You know you can depend on QNN for honest news. Now we want you to know about an honest source of information on one of the country's most desirable vacation destinations, Carmel by the Sea on California's beautiful Central Coast. That source is the best address in Carmel, carmel.com. Just a few simple clicks and you're visiting a website that mirrors all that Carmel stands for: quality, character, tradition, beauty, the great outdoors by the sea, cultural heritage, and the best shopping, charming inns, superb dining, world-class art, music, and theater, a cornucopia of delights. So when you're planning your next getaway, go to the best address in Carmel, carmel.com, for tips on everything Carmel. Then put that information to good use by visiting Carmel by the Sea for an unforgettable getaway. Carmel.com.
NASA is facing two problems at the International Space Station, including a ripped solar wing. However, today NASA canceled a spacewalk scheduled for tomorrow to work on the damage and pushed it back until Friday. Tropical storm Noel is responsible for at least 60 deaths in Haiti and the Dominican Republic. It is going across Cuba and headed toward Florida. The Consumer Product Safety Commission has announced that Toys R Us has recalled 16,000 Chinese-made Elite Operations military-style toys because of possible lead contamination. Today is the last day for talks before a possible strike between the Hollywood writers and producers. The main issue is the amount of money the writers will get from the sale of DVDs and other digital distribution of television shows. The Federal Reserve met today and decided to cut the key interest rate by a quarter of a percentage point. It is now 4.5%. The Commerce Department reports over the summer the U.S. economy grew at a 3.9% rate, the fastest pace in a year and a half. Gold is trading at $796 even an ounce. Light sweet crude has been trading above the $94 a barrel mark, currently at $94.53 on the New York Mercantile Exchange and near the close of Wall Street today. The Dow Jones up 131 points, the NASDAQ up 40, and the S&P 500 up 18. There's always more at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Allie Dramov.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Happy Halloween to everyone in the Inside Scoop audience. Halloween, of course, is a traditional day where we dress up our children into very scary costumes and try to scare each other, but really just go out and have a lot of fun. Some would argue that global warming is an extremely scary prospect, far more scarier than ghosts and ghouls, and other argues that, you know, it's really all overblown. Well, it's hard to know. We have great fires in San Diego and throughout California. We have ice sheets melting. We have the Northwest Passage for the first time showing up in at least recorded human history. That, of course, means that the ice around the Arctic has melted enough to allow ships to go around the north part of Canada and Alaska. But is it that big a deal? You know, conservatives used to argue that global warming wasn't happening. And then they said, well, global warming's happening, but man's not causing it. It's all a natural event. And now a new breed of economic conservatives, such as Bjorn Lomborg of the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, he argues, yeah, okay, global warming's happening, and man's causing it, but there are cheaper and easier ways to deal with it than reducing carbon emissions under things like the Kyoto Protocol. Well, I've invited today an expert today in global warming, and she knows everything there is to know about it, the science, the politics, and she can also answer your questions. Her name is Angela Anderson. She's Vice President for Climate Programs at the National Environmental Trust. Angela, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to be here.
Well, let's start with some of the things that are going on around the world, and you can tell me whether or not it's attributable in part or in whole or mostly to global warming. Let's start with the recent fires in Southern California. Is that a global warming event?
Well, I think that's one of those things that is difficult to say. The fires in California are caused, you know, obviously it were made possible because it was a drier year than it has been, as I understand in California. And the other things that were, and that's consistent with the one would see in global warming. So I think the one thing you'll hear me say a lot is exactly that phrase. What we're seeing now with things like the wildfires and the sort of hurricane patterns are consistent with the things that scientists say we can expect under warming temperatures. But it's always going to be very difficult to attribute any one weather event to climate change.
Well, let's move on to hurricanes. Some say, and you can confirm this, that hurricanes are more severe, that each year they are occurring with more severity, with higher wind speeds, with more devastating consequences. One, is that true? Obviously, you know, it's not like one year there's no hurricanes and next year there are tons. It's the kind of thing that grows over time. Is it true that hurricanes are getting worse? And if so, can we put a number on how bad they're getting worse and whether that's attributable to global warming?
Yeah, I think that's an area actually where the scientists were willing to be a little bit more definitive this year. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, what we refer to as the IPCC, issued their report. This report comes out roughly every 5 years, and it's essentially all the scientists of the world looking over all the scientific studies that have been done and deciding what can we say about that. And on hurricanes, they decided that, in fact, they were seeing a trend of exactly what you said, greater severity of more intense hurricanes, greater wind speeds, and that those were very likely caused by the increased both air temperature and more importantly, the fact that the water temperature, which is you know, really does fuel the intensity of a hurricane, was going up, and that the increase in intensity that we're seeing, not necessarily the number of hurricanes, but the increase in intensity, is is beginning to be a pattern that is quite consistent with what they expect to see with global warming.
And that's from both air temperature and water temperature?
Correct, but I think the water temperature is more determinative in the case of hurricanes.
Okay, and speaking of water temperature, we have a number of glaciers melting. There's all kinds of movies showing us a glacier the size of Rhode Island that collapsed up in the Arctic. We have the Northwest Passage opening up around Canada. How severe, how much can we measure the melting of the glaciers in, say, the Arctic and around Greenland?
Yeah, I think that the rapid nature, particularly this summer that we saw of melting, is probably one of the more alarming indications of the global warming is not just coming, but it is in fact here. And it is one of those trends that scientists are looking at with particular concern because it's happening faster than they had predicted, you know, 5, 10, 20 years ago. So they're seeing a melting happening at a rate that they didn't think would happen for another decade or so. So the impacts of global warming that they feared are coming sooner. And that is a real source. And you know, I think it's hard for people like us. You it sounds like you have a good handle on it, but I think when, you know, I grew up in Colorado. I just came back from North Dakota. Glaciers melting in a lot, you know, and what does that have to do with me? But it has tremendous impacts, not just on the sea level rise, but also, you know, it has an accelerator effect on the global temperature. It can make our temperature increases happen even faster, which then accelerates all of the other global warming impacts like drought and severe and unpredictable weather, those sorts of things.
Now, let me give you a contrary view. You've probably heard of Bjorn Lomborg. He wrote a piece recently in the Washington Post that was that he actually conceded that global warming was happening and that mankind was causing it, but he felt that a lot of the fears were overblown. And one of the things he pointed out was, let's not look always at the North Pole. Let's look at the South Pole, and that actually warming increases rain, and therefore the ice cap around Antarctica will grow, and therefore that any rise in sea level caused by the North Pole might be mitigated by the South Pole. Can you respond to that?
Well, you know, I think that it's a really interesting evolution that you've seen people like Lomborg go through and many others, and the fact that it's just undeniable now that global warming is a fact of life, and it's not some hoax, as one of the senators on the Environment Committee likes to call it, Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma. But in fact, it is a real phenomenon.
Which happens to be a real oil state. It's
I'm
just
sorry?
Interesting. It must be pure coincidence that Oklahoma produces so much oil. But I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No. I'm sure we'll come back to this.
Right. We will.
But I think it really is quite telling that just say no and absolute denial of the science isn't possible anymore. So looking, and I think what they're doing is they're picking up on the real anxiety that many citizens, Americans, and around the world felt that when they heard about global warming, they thought, oh my gosh, this could be catastrophic. So they're trying to use their authority of scientists to sort of calm their fears by saying, well, it may not be that bad. This could it could happen this way, it could happen that way. And the bottom line is we don't know. So the prudent way to respond is to not panic, to do the things that we know that we can do to avert the worst consequences of global warming, and not gamble that we might actually get ice caps growing, building up in the South Pole. I'm not a scientist, so I don't know the validity of that. I'm happy to check that out. But the bottom line is, you know, in terms of what the impacts are, the implications of the science for our everyday life and for policy making, you know, do you gamble on, well, maybe they're wrong, or do you start doing the things that are prudent to do in case they're right?
By the way, you are not a scientist. You are at the National Environmental Trust. Listeners have a right to know your bias. Tell us what the National Environmental Trust is.
Sure. NET is a national environmental group. We were founded about 10 years ago, really with the idea that we needed to bring citizens a real professional voice on environmental issues in Washington and scientists to use similar tools and techniques to that that the corporate world uses to reach out to the media, communicate our issues both to policymakers, to citizens, and make sure that the environment really has kind of a top-notch representative in Washington, and that's what we've been trying to do for the last decade or so. And we're actually this year merging with the Pew Charitable Trust. We will become in January 1 something called the Pew Environment Group.
Okay. Now, in Washington, a lot of people are behind the times. Senator Inhofe is not the only one. I've had Republicans on my show, and what's interesting is that just really 4 years ago when I began in radio, not that long ago, a number of them were denying that global warming is occurring. Virtually no one does that anymore. But the second argument that they make is that, all right, it's happening. We can see it. You know, we don't deny that the degrees are going up. We can't deny science. But who says mankind's causing it? We're coming out of the last ice age, and this is natural, and the whole Earth has gotten much warmer and much cooler over the course of millennia. And this is all part of a natural process. Go back to your homes. Don't be so concerned. You know, go back and use your cars. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think actually what's interesting is we just had a hearing in Washington where all the Republican statements, they didn't even go that far. They weren't even challenging the human causation anymore. So I'm happy to report that in some corners, even that argument is beginning to lose its validity. But the answer to that is pretty simple. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they're coming out with their final report this year in about 2 weeks. But the real news out of that report was for the first time this panel said that they were 90% certain, and that's about as certain as scientists get, that global warming was caused by is being caused in part by humans. That's something that this panel's not been willing to say in the past, or has said with much less certainty than they were willing to say this time. And the reason they're so certain is that there's so many lines of evidence that it's not possible in a scientist's mind for it to be a coincidence anymore. We talked a little bit about the ice melting. Well, there's several ways to track the temperature over the long term. You know, we track air temperature really for only like the last 100 or so years. But in terms of other temperature effects, ice cores are just like tree rings in terms of, you know, that you can take a look at the melting and the remelting over the years and see what the temperature was like going back, you know, hundreds of years. You can do the same. And so when they look at the kind of the air temperatures as far back as we can go, the ice cores as far back as we can go, and then just sheer observations between the increase in pollution and the increase in temperatures, the increase in greenhouse gas pollution tracks so closely those changes in temperature that it's just sort of beyond deniability anymore that there's a relationship there.
How does this work? We burn fossil fuels in our car. There's pollution out of our exhaust. We burn them in heating our homes. How exactly does the air get warmer, and what's the principal cause of it? Is it factories? Is it cars? What's causing it?
Yeah, that's a great question. We always assume that people kind of get it, and it's not instinctive. The global warming, I think when we first started talking about it, people talked a lot about the greenhouse effect. And I know when I first started hearing about it, I thought the greenhouse effect was a bad thing. The greenhouse effect really refers to the fact that there is this layer, this atmosphere that surrounds the Earth that as the sun's rays come down to Earth and warm the ground, as it were, and warm the water, the thin layer of atmosphere traps that heat and keeps our climate habitable. It makes it comfortable for human beings to live here. That's why there's, as far as we know, life on this planet and not others. So the greenhouse effect is a good thing. But what happens when you burn all those things all the things you were talking about, burning fossil fuels, putting carbon dioxide in particular, some other chemical compounds into the air, is that it's thickening that layer of atmosphere above of the Earth, and it acts just like a blanket. And so it's keeping too much heat or a rise, you know, more heat surrounding the Earth, which raises the temperature both in the water and on the air. And so the greenhouse effect isn't the problem. It's the pollution that's thickening the atmosphere that's intensifying the greenhouse effect and making it warmer.
I remember when I was a kid and I used to study the planets. That's back when Pluto was a planet. I am that old. But I remember one of the planets was Venus, which is the closest planet to Earth, a little bit closer to the sun. But in Venus, the atmosphere was so thick, I remember, that they described what they thought the surface of the planet to be, basically, you know, boiling gases and so forth. Is the fear that the Earth is becoming more like Venus in that respect, a thicker atmosphere trapping more heat in?
Yeah, I think that would be an extreme example and
obviously,
not a scenario.
I don't expect it to go that
far.
I've heard predicted,
so I'm hoping, you know, I'm sure in California it feels like you have that the Earth is boiling between you. Or what's that? There was a movie about Los Angeles when the what was that crazy movie?
I don't remember.
Anyway, I haven't heard any predictions that are quite that severe.
No, I don't mean that we're going to go that far. I'm just trying to, in other words, in a way to understand what's happening, it's the thickening of the atmosphere that traps the heat in. And yet other environmentalists are concerned that we use a certain kind of fluorocarbons that would decrease the ozone. And explain to me why that wouldn't then help decrease the atmosphere and help end the, you know, lessen the greenhouse effect. Well, maybe those two pollutions could counteract each other.
Good questions. We all got rid of our aerosol cans.
Right.
Back in the late 70s.
That was 70s, the 70s, the 80s. Right. My mom couldn't use that hairspray she used to use.
That's exactly right. And that's actually one of the most tremendous examples of both science and policymakers coming together and an international agreement that actually worked, where we said, whoa, we're putting a hole in the ozone layer, and we're letting too much bad rays in, or damaging rays from the sun into the Earth. And so we needed to stop the holes in the ozone layer. So we banned CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, and using what was something called the Montreal Protocol. And it basically developed countries, industrialized countries, agreed that they would look for alternatives to aerosols. They did that. They sold that technology, or in some cases gave that technology to countries, and so we were able to minimize the use of CFCs there. And we have, you know, significantly slowed the ozone depletion. So I think that's one lesson from the CFC. It's still a problem. I know that we just renewed our commitment to the Montreal Protocol. And there is you're right in that the connection between it's almost a reverse problem from the global warming problem, and they do interact. But I think that in large part, all of the things that we would do to avert global warming will in fact have similar, you know, would be beneficial for the ozone layer problem, which is actually improving instead of getting worse.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I fully admit I'm a political pundit. I'm not a scientist. But it just seems like in a very simplistic way, and I realize some of these arguments are simplistic, you know, hey, one increases the atmosphere, the other decreases the atmosphere, you know, maybe they can counteract each other. Let me ask you, in terms of the effects of sea level, I mean, the idea, you know, Al Gore, Inconvenient Truth, suggests that's the biggest fear, that the sea levels will rise, that those of us that live on the coast, including right here in Washington, D.C., on the banks of the Potomac River, but all over the United States in low-lying areas, that, in other words, New Orleans, a city below sea level, would start popping up everywhere in the coast of the United States. What can we tell scientifically about if sea levels have gone up, have the oceans risen, and what we can tell about how that's going to happen in the future?
Yeah, this is one area where folks are... that seems to be a bit controversial. Everyone agrees sea levels are going to rise, and everyone agrees that if Greenland melts, that the sea level rise will be on the extreme end, on the high end of the predictions, which is, you know, like I think 10 to 15 meters is the high end prediction.
30 feet, 45 feet.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Exactly. Now, what what we're hoping to do is, of course, avert the melting of Greenland, and how close we are to that. To that is, you know, obviously that was part of what was covered in Convenient Truth. It's quite alarming that in fact the notion that it actually all could melt is pretty frightening in and of itself. So if I think our goal has got to be averting that particular calamity. If Greenland doesn't melt, then the sea level rise is probably going to be rather modest and rather slow. So we're looking at not the next 50 years, the next decade, where we'll see significant increase. For the United States, you know, that's problematic when you're thinking about coastal property, obviously, especially, you know, if you want oceanfront property, over time, it's not going to be there. There are probably more immediate problems than that we'll be facing, though, which are storm surges. You know, not just the hurricanes, but the flooding and the storm surge that comes after that are probably bigger issues for the coast. Being able to get insurance if you live on the coast is already a problem, because insurance companies are on to global warming. And they're not writing policies for those places anymore. People in South Carolina, Florida, et cetera, can tell us all already about that. And the real problem where sea level rise, whether it's slight or whether it's extreme, is going to be in other countries, particularly in other developed countries. If you think about how much of China is developed along the coastline and the density of that population, if that population continues to move inland, and this is true in Israel, it's true in lots of countries with some coastal area, and particularly countries that are close to each other and not exactly that friendly to one another, just the sheer migration of people and the disruption that gets caused, even by a modest amount of sea level rise, in developing countries and in unstable parts of the world, that really does pose a very big problem, not really from an ecological perspective, but from a security perspective.
Help us out here. Is a hurricane and a tsunami? I mean, a tsunami, you sort of imagine these huge waves coming ashore. Are they basically the same kind of thing, or are they really very different things? And is that caused by global warming as well?
I think that there is some concern that it's similar to kind of the water temperature-related effects of global warming. Tsunamis could be become more frequent and could be more intense. So I think they're similar in that way. I think, for example, typhoons are you know, just hurricanes in another part of the world. But the tsunami, okay, I think, is a different meteorological event that is exactly what you said. It's really more about the waves than the wind.
Now, there's a recent study, which I fully admit I have not read, but I have read about, by Stanford, by Chris Field, a professor at Stanford. And he seems to argue that carbon dioxide emissions are growing even faster than the IPCC has said, and that one of the reasons is that the oceans aren't absorbing as much carbon dioxide as they used to, and that means that it actually increases in sort of a multiplicative effect.
What do you know about those? Multiplier effect, exactly.
Right. I mean, are those respected studies?
I was just reading some reviews of those studies. There's a whole email community that discusses this thing online, and I have trouble keeping up with them because it seems like every week there's a new study and a conversation about how valid is this. And I do think that the notion, there's a big discussion among both climate policy people as well as scientists about both oceans and forests as sinks, you know, as the ability to hold and absorb carbon dioxide. We rely on the oceans to do a lot of that, and if they are becoming less effective sinks for carbon dioxide, you will see exactly what you said. The emissions will grow faster, or we will see an acceleration of emissions that are really just beyond our control. We're burning or polluting more. It's just that the environment is holding less. That's also true with deforestation, for example. The more trees that we cut down, the more soil that is tilled for agriculture, that releases carbon dioxide into the air, whereas if you keep those trees in place, they absorb the carbon dioxide in the air, and which is a very beneficial effect. So all of those things, the fact that the ocean's actually able to hold less is a very big problem and just makes our challenge of reducing emissions that much harder.
And planting trees is one of the solutions. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to go from science to politics, from the problems that exist to the possible solutions at hand. What helps the problem? What harms the problem? What's the most expensive? What does it mean for the developing world? And after all, what's going on here in Washington? I also want to give you a chance to call in and ask all those global warming questions that have been bothering you, that leave you up at night, what we really have to fear this Halloween, and what may be a bit overblown. The toll-free number is 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
This is the Head-On Radio Network.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. And now a word or two in defense of the free speech rights of the Reverend Fred Phelps, that crazy right-wing homophobe from Kansas. I met him once. He was here in Madison, Wisconsin, with his God Hates Gays sign, though he used an uglier word than gays. He was picketing across the street from a church that was too liberal for his medieval tastes, and he had his usual hideous picket signs and crazed look, as did his small flock. Now he's taken his theological horror show on the road, picketing of all things funerals of U.S. soldiers. His followers, including his kids, hold up signs that say, "Thank God for dead soldiers." Seems the right reverend believes that God's punishing the men and women in uniform because America is too permissive on homosexuality. The guy really knows how to make friends and influence people. But now he's being sued by the father of Lance Corporal Matthew Snyder, whose funeral Phelps picketed back in March 2006. I hope Phelps wins this one. I really do. As loathsome as his views are, as obnoxious and rude is his tactic to picket funerals, he still has the right to free expression. The First Amendment doesn't prohibit loathsome or obnoxious or rude speech. It's supposed to defend it, and so are we. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Tune in to Night Sounds every Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music releases, special segments like One Hit Wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sounds dedications with the sassy and classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications, direct your email to nightsounds@billyshearsmusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat room this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Hey, thanks for lending an ear.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Inside Scoop, we're talking this Halloween about possibly the scariest thing that is encompassing the entire planet. We're talking about global warming. My guest is Angela Anderson, the Vice President for Climate Programs at the National Environmental Trust. In the first half of the hour, we talked about the science, the problem, the fact that there is a problem, and the fact that man is causing the problem. There seems to be a lot of denial of that right here in Washington, D.C., including some, well, let's just say, careful editing of testimony. One of the things that Barbara Boxer discovered, in fact, at the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, is that a woman by the name of Judy Geberding, who was the director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, had a 14-page draft talking about global warming. Only 4 pages were shown to the Senate, because it turns out that some 10 pages about the science of global warming were cut out. We definitely have politicians that don't want to know the truth about global warming, what Nobel Prize winner Al Gore called an inconvenient truth, because after all, it's much easier to make profits by burning fossil fuels. This isn't just a problem in the United States, but in developing countries like China and India as well. So, Angela, I'd like to ask you about, well, the counterexample. Not the counterexample scientifically, but the counterexample economically. Isn't there a lot of money to be made by burning fossil fuels?
Oh, sure there is. And there is no question that that's going to mean solving the problem of global warming is going to be very, very difficult. And those same companies that are profiting from burning of fossil fuels, buying, selling, and you have to say it, you know, we're those consumers, so we're a part of the problem as well. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. It's the heart of our economy. This is not going to happen easily or overnight, and in fact, those companies are the ones that are responsible for the fact that nothing's happened, nothing significant has happened on global warming yet. But they're changing.
Now, who are these companies? Who are the biggest profiteers? Are they oil companies, car companies? Who are the people who profit most from burning fossil fuels? Maybe it's partly those of us that like to drive.
Right. You know, I couldn't tell you which company. You know, ExxonMobil is certainly up there, and they've become kind of the poster. They were the poster child for climate skepticism and the sort of Just Say No campaign on global warming for many, many years. They have recently also stop doing that, but you know, obviously, it just big oil companies, big electric companies that burn coal to generate power. These are multinational companies worth billions of dollars, and they've got a lot of political influence.
Let me ask you specifically about coal. I'm like most Americans would like to see us not be so dependent on foreign oil. I happen to believe one of the reasons we're in the Middle East fighting dictators there and not fighting the many dictators who live outside the Middle East is because not of what's going on the ground, but that black gold under the ground. The Bush administration tells us we have our own black gold. It's coal. It's throughout America. It will make us energy independent. Will burning coal, another fossil fuel, cause just as much damage to the environment, or maybe even more, than burning oil?
Yeah, it absolutely does. Coal is probably one of this country's biggest problems in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. I think it's the single biggest problem, along with automobiles. Obviously, oil is a part of it. But in terms of our power capacity and the way we heat our homes, it's all about coal. And in terms of where that coal is mined and the companies that are relying on it, it just has incredibly broad political reach, probably stretching, you know, across, you know, 8, 10, 12 states, way beyond the number of people actually employed in the industry.
We do need energy. You know, even in Europe, they have some cars, and I can't imagine America, which is very much based on the automobile, giving up our cars. Well, what is the answer? Are we going to have, you know, hybrid fossil, fuel cells or wind energy, solar energy? Where would you like to see? We got to have our energy. Where would you like to see it coming from?
That's absolutely true. What has to happen first is we have to change the economic incentives in this country so that all of those things are possible. And we're close, you know, I think that's people are beginning to understand that. But I think everything that hybrids, plug-in cars, ultimately hydrogen cars, are all a part, and better mass transit and more extensive mass transit, all are part of the solution, as well as more use of natural gas, solar, sustainable biofuels. All of those things have to be, but we do not yet have an economic system that internalizes the cost of the fossil fuels that we're burning. And that's the first step that government has got to take, is to put a price on carbon dioxide and make sure that we're incentivizing the technologies that are less polluting.
A carbon tax, a gasoline tax, a fuel tax.
It doesn't have to be a tax. There are, the country went a long ways to cleaning up our air pollution when we had an acid rain in the 70s. And that was the first time that we used something called a cap-and-trade system. You put a mandatory limit on the pollutant that's causing the environmental problem, and you issue permits to the companies who emit that pollutant. They can reduce their emissions and sell those permits then, or they can, if they overpollute, they have to buy permits. That system was very successful at reducing our acid rain problem, and it's what the U.S. promoted, actually, as part of the Kyoto Treaty. It's what Europe is beginning to use. I mean, it's what is being proposed for the United States in terms of how we reduce our carbon dioxide emissions.
There's a bill that's proposed largely by Joe Lieberman and John Warner, to some extent John McCain, seen as a bipartisan bill that would do some of that cap and trade. Is the bill better than nothing, and then does it go far enough?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's been an amazing, very unusual development of climate, of legislation on climate in this country. Obviously, nothing's ever passed. In fact, nothing's ever gone through an official committee. We've had a few votes on the Senate floor that were largely symbolic. But what we have seen over time is that Senator McCain introduced really the first, well, I shouldn't say that, Congressman Waxman back in the 80s actually introduced the first global
warming bill. One of my favorite congressmen. I was just praising him yesterday, but go ahead, please.
No, he's a legend, and he's still here, and we're thrilled. But more recently, really, Senator McCain on the campaign trail really was pushed hard to have, you know, take a position on global warming. And to his credit, he studied up and he found out, you know, that it was a problem, and he introduced a bill. And not only did that, he forced it to the Senate floor in opposition to his own party's leadership. And that was in 2003, or the first time that vote took place.
But it didn't pass.
I'm sorry?
It didn't pass. The bill
didn't pass. Didn't pass. I think the first time it got 42
was it close?
Votes, the next year got 44. But what's interesting is every bill that's been introduced, there's a theory on environmental policy that you have to go in with your best effort because you're going to compromise down from there and everything's going to get weaker. And in fact, the McCain bill was quite modest in 2002. It got stronger in 2003, 2005. And what we've seen in the Warner-Lieberman bill is that it's not as strong as we'd like to see it, but it's stronger than the McCain-Lieberman bill was. You know, and so every year, probably in response to the science, in response to sort of the political demand for it, these bills are getting stronger. Could the bill that you've referenced, it certainly is not the strongest one that's been introduced, but it's certainly the strongest bipartisan bill, and that's important. So we're pleased with where they're beginning.
What does the bill do? It's far better than nothing. What does the bill do exactly? Does it do some of that cap and trade stuff that you were talking about?
It does. What it does is it puts a limit on carbon dioxide, actually all greenhouse gases. So that would include things like methane, for example. But it only caps three sectors of the economy: the electric utility industry, big industry, sort of industrial boiler type. You know, if you have a factory and you have a boiler that heats it, those emissions are capped. And oil at the refinery level. Those are the three. Those three sectors are responsible for 80% of the greenhouse gases in America. And
that's an important point. I want you to repeat that.
Sure.
The utilities. What 80% of the greenhouse gases?
80% of the greenhouse gases are a result from heavy industry.
Heavy industry.
The electric power industry. And
electric power.
Transportation, they call it, but it's really just oil at the refineries.
So not even us driving our cars, because everyone's
looking around at the people driving
Hummers, and we all give them dirty looks. But and I'm sure they're not doing a good thing. But they're not eight as much of the problem. 80% is heavy industry, the utilities, and oil refineries. That's very interesting to me, because those are things that are much easier to regulate than all of us, you know, driving around in our SUVs.
They're the largest single sources of pollution, and that way, which makes them great candidates to be regulated by a cap-and-trade system. Cars, we absolutely have to do better on the tailpipe emissions, and you can do that through greater fuel efficiency from cars, but it would be very hard to include auto emissions in a cap-and-trade system. It's just not as efficient. It's not going to work.
We did the catalytic converter in the 70s. That seemed to have gotten rid of. We got rid of leaded gasoline.
That's exactly right.
Help us here?
The catalytic converter was a per vehicle fix, right? You said every car in America has to have this.
Right.
And so if we say every vehicle in America has to get between 25 and 35 miles per gallon or 25 or 40, whatever the right target is, we think, you know, fleet-wide it should be a 35 mile per gallon average at minimum. If you did that, then that's the most effective way to reduce the emissions from automobiles. If you said, if you said to the automakers, if you produce a number, you know, X number of cars that meet, you know, regulating the emissions of the cars through the automakers in a cap and trade system is just impractical. It's not going to work.
Now, how this is all national politics. How does this compare internationally? There's a lot of talk of the Kyoto Protocol. I think most of us don't quite understand all the Kyoto Protocol does. Of course, it was signed by Bill Clinton, but never ratified by the United States Senate. I know that critics like Lomborg, he says, you know, why spend $20 to solve $2 worth of problems? Kyoto's just too expensive. And a number of people complain, you know, China and India are really the big polluters. We're bad, but they're even worse. What is the international problem, and how can we use solutions in that regard?
Well, the U.S. is the only the U.S. and Australia are all the only countries that have not ratified the Kyoto Protocol. So it's not such an odd, you know, it really is kind of the law of the international land, not ours. The cap and trade system that we were talking about is the model that the world adopted when they adopted Kyoto. There's a couple of exceptions. What they did was, again, we talked about the ozone layer problem and the Montreal Protocol. The rules of the road were that the industrialized countries, those most responsible for the pollution that's already in the atmosphere, and those most able to combat their pollution with minimal effects on their economy, should go first, and that those countries would come up, they would cap their emissions for the next 10 years, and they'd meet, you know, every 10 years to come up with a new one, but they would cap, and then they would set up a trading system, so internationally you could trade these credits. So that's happened. In Europe, it's really the first round. They're just getting started. They've just
so it is happening without
regs.
Us.
Sorry,
we're not a part of it, but it is happening without us.
Exactly,
Canada's
exactly.
Doing it. Everywhere, and Europe is doing it. Is it,
yep.
is it working? I mean, can they do this without us?
You know, the great news is they did us a really big favor. They didn't wait for us. So they have learned a lot of lessons. When they first set up the carbon market in Europe, they didn't have a good inventory of which companies were putting out which pollutants, and so they gave out too many permits, and that created some windfall profits, and it didn't set up the incentives they wanted, but they fixed it. And now we are beginning to see reductions. They have figured out that efficiency is the cheapest way that they can reduce their, and they've got tremendous policies in place. And if you just travel in Europe, you see this everywhere. You know, you walk out of a room, the lights go off. How smart is that?
Right, that's,
you know?
True.
So the best thing the world did was not wait on the United States. They did get started. But you're right that they can only go so far without the world's biggest polluter being a part of that agreement. And the negotiations for a new agreement that will succeed the Kyoto Protocol begin actually this December. All the countries are going, and in fact, I think many of the members of the U.S. Congress are going to go to send the signal to the world that this administration only has another year in office, and this Congress is committing to getting the U.S. on track to doing the right thing.
But how painful would Kyoto be to our economy? I mean, it's got to cost.
You know, we're going to have to negotiate our way into an international agreement in some fashion. It does not need to be painful to the economy. What the U.S. can't do is play catch-up, and that's unfortunate. I mean, if we were to sign Kyoto today, you know, the rest of the countries are 8 years ahead of us, right? And while we continue to pollute, they stabilize their emissions, or they at least set up the regulatory infrastructure to start doing that. We're just beginning to do that, and we hope that the Congress will do that in the next year or two. It is, according to all the studies that we've done around both the domestic legislation and the Kyoto agreement, it is quite possible for the U.S. perhaps not to meet the Kyoto targets, but to meet some ambitious goals on climate. And what people would see, you know, $1, $2 increase on their electric bills. And
just $1 or $2 increase a month.
Because the price of electricity has actually been going down over the last few years and is projected to continue to go down per kilowatt hour, that what will happen is it will stay the same. And what we're seeing is, you know, we didn't get the savings we might have gotten, but it may not even increase. We may not see the downward cycle that it has been on.
But a lot of Americans are looking to China and India and saying, well, you know, this isn't fair. We're restraining ourselves. You know, Europe, well, they're the good citizens of the world, Europe and Canada. They seem to always do the right thing. You know, we're kind of in the middle. We're sort of begrudging. But then China and India, they're the bad citizens. I mean, okay, they're very poor countries. China's a dictatorship, but they have billions of people. They're, you know, 10 times the size of us, and they are using pollutants that, you know, we haven't used since the 1960s. How do you address this argument that why are we going to clean, you know, we maybe not, you know, try to reach European standards? We're going to take sort of things that are already pretty clean and make them very clean when we've got all this massive soot coming out in the eastern part of the globe?
Now, you know, I think that China and India are both increasingly aware that their rhetoric of, you know, you industrialized countries created this problem, you fix it and don't interfere with our right to grow and develop, which, by the way, is not a bad argument, you know, if you're them.
I get it, but right. but it doesn't really help us any.
Right, it doesn't help us any, but what's interesting is that most of the energy and the greenhouse gas emissions, particularly in China, is responsible for, it's infrastructure building. They really are growing their entire country right now. They're building power plants, and frankly, they're becoming the heavy industry capital of the world. And so instead of, you know, having polluting steel plants in our country, we're importing steel from China because it's cheaper and because the pollution's over there. So we get the benefits of not having that heavy industry in this country. Our labor friends would argue that we've lost their jobs.
Yeah, I was just going to say, our steel workers lose their jobs, and they do it for, I don't know, $1 a day. I mean, that's
right.
Something like that.
But here's what's different. What's different is that they have, even though they are growing incredibly fast and cannot grow and cannot pollute the way they are, you know, for a very long time, they're already taking steps to address that. They have more fuel efficient cars, and more their standards for cars are more stringent than the United States.
Really?
Yep.
That's very interesting.
Now they tend to drive smaller cars, but they specifically put in place these emissions because they didn't want the SUV explosion to happen in China. They saw it happen in the United States, and they deliberately put these regulations in place to discourage SUVs in China.
So, let me go to another developing country, if I can, that's done an amazing thing with cars that every time I read about it, it just seems, I don't know, like a miracle. And that is the miracle of Brazil, a country that, my understanding is, took 40% of their vehicle fleet. Brazil is not much smaller in population than we are, nor in size than we are. They're about the same size in population. They're a lot poorer nation. And took about 40% of it, and it runs on sugarcane, which I don't believe pollutes the environment at all. Is that true, or is that an exaggerated statistic?
I think that it's basically true. What you're talking about is the move towards biofuels. In there, it happens to be sugarcane, and in this country, it happens to be corn. But those can be polluting, we have to be careful about the explosion of those. For example, when you shift, part of Brazil has a big problem in the sense that the emissions accomplishments, you see the reductions they've gotten in their cars, they've got a problem because they've cut down forests in order to plant sugarcane.
Right,
that
right.
Fuels the car.
Yeah, it's never easy, is it?
No, it's a little bit complicated, but Brazil is an interesting country. They are active participants in the international climate change process. They want to change the incentives with regard to forests, and they're I think a pretty productive part of that conversation. And so, you know, we really are at a very exciting time. The people who are both a big part of and potentially a big part of the solution, world leaders in China, the United States, Brazil, India, they are all talking, and they are all saying a lot of the right things, that we've got to have a new agreement internationally. We've got to get on top of this problem. We don't have a lot of time to do it. And so everything gets, the more specific you get, and the more you talk about individual country obligations, the harder it gets. But this is a real opportunity. The next 2 to 3 years really are going to be make it or break it for the United States and in fact, the world, in terms of, can we solve this problem? Can we get it together to set the right framework in place? It's an exciting time, but it is a scary time here at Halloween.
I was just going to say, you sound really optimistic. I mean, a lot of the people who talk about global warming seem to be the gloom and doom variety. They show polar bears hanging on to a piece of ice and, you know, losing their young. You sound optimistic. Really? I mean, is there grounds for optimism here?
Well, you know, the difference, I think, is if you – for 7 years I've been at this in some capacity, and the first five we were voices in the wilderness, right? And God love, you know, Vice President Gore and many others who've been at this much longer than I have. Just where we started this program, right? Climate skeptics, this thing wasn't even real until literally a year and a half ago. And now, everybody's sort of gotten it. The scary part is, can we move fast enough to take of this new public awareness, the corporate acknowledgement that they have to do something? Can we lock in the kind of agreements we need? We're going to have to move really, really fast, but it's an exciting time if we all do our jobs right. We might actually turn the corner.
Quick side point. You mentioned corn fuel in the United States. I know that a lot of gasoline, when I go to get gas, it mentions that it's 10% ethanol, which, of course, is a fuel made from corn. Does that help the environment, or is that, you know, the same kind of pollution as coal or fossil fuels?
Not exactly the same kind. The problem with corn was a great way to get the country off of oil, so we began to look at other ways to power our cars. And there is a kind of biofuel that you can make out of gas and non-coal sources, but there have to be some minimal standards for those sorts of biofuels to make sure that they're not just as polluting in terms of their life cycle as oil and coal are. And so we have to change the economic signals we're sending. Right now, corn is hugely subsidized, and we need to get to a point where we have more sustainable biofuels and that they can actually make profit.
How about hydrogen? I saw a recent ad for the Mercedes, a hydrogen car, which sounded, again, fantastic. The idea that its waste product is water is just amazing. Of course, I remember the Hindenburg, I think, had hydrogen and blew up. Is there reason to believe that hydrogen could be the fuel of the future? And if so, how far away is that?
Yeah, I think the predictions I've seen is that hydrogen is probably about 20 years away.
So I think it's
got a lot of work to do. And the other thing we have to be careful is, a lot of times the feedstock for hydrogen is coal.
There
you go. None of this is ever simple. There's a lot of interim solutions, though. I think hydrogen's going to come. But in between, we can have more hybrids, more efficient hybrids that are more powerful, and plug-in cars and better mass transit. So there's... You know, I think originally the Bush administration kept talking about hydrogen because they didn't want to do anything until hydrogen became available. We have to make use of the technologies we have right now.
Angela, we have about 30 seconds left. What would you want listeners senators hearing your voice to do to affect the political situation, to call their senator, the member of Congress, ask them to support bills like the Lieberman-McCain bill or even stronger bills? Is that what they can mostly do, buy hybrid cars? Give us a quick.
I think in terms of that if there was ever a problem that we needed government involved in order to change it, this is one of them. So we, number one really is call your senators. I think the Lieberman-Warner bill is an excellent start. Support that bill and support strengthening amendments.
Anderson.
There's some terrific tips out there, I think, associated with Inconvenient Truth and Al Gore's website. But, you know, it's not hard for people today to find out what they can do. Change your light bulbs to compact fluorescence if you can. Keep your do what you can personally, but make sure that your leaders know that you're watching and you need them to do the right thing.
We're going to have to leave it there. Angela Anderson, thank you so much for coming here on The Inside Scoop. And that's it for The Inside Scoop. Tune in tomorrow. We went a few seconds over, but they'll deal with that in the studio. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'll see you tomorrow right here on The Inside Scoop.
This is the Quality News Network. The Senate Judiciary Committee will vote Tuesday on President Bush's nominee for Attorney General Michael Mukasey, who has submitted nearly 200 pages of elaboration on his positions. However, Mukasey has reportedly not given a definitive answer on whether the controversial technique known as waterboarding is torture. Many Democrats have said it is illegal and they will not vote for him unless he categorically answers the question. The Democratic candidates running for president in 2008 took part in a televised debate last night in Philadelphia. Senator Barack Obama and former Senator John Edwards took on frontrunner Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. They challenged her candor and consistency. President Bush is trying to take the offensive against Congress in health care policy and other budget issues. He accused Democrats of supporting federalized health care instead of a free market approach that he favors. In Spain, 7 of the 28 people on trial for the 2004 Madrid train bombings were let off entirely, including one suspect who had allegedly bragged that he was the mastermind behind the blasts. However, 21 people were convicted on at least some of the charges. A 25-year-old man pleaded guilty today in connection with an alleged plot to attack soldiers at Fort Dix.